Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai.
And I am Molly, also known as Molly Wood, senior tech correspondent and sometime host of Marketplace. But this is not that. This is Make Me Smart.
This is not that. I'm Kai Ryssdal, the most of the time host of Marketplace. But again, this is not that. This is Make Me Smart, the thing that we do where we get to talk about all kinds of other stuff.
Oh, my goodness. So much stuff. Can we just take a moment, as we do almost every week, to express gratitude for the fact that we have this podcast now so that it can be an outlet?
Yeah, honestly, because there's so much to talk about. Interestingly enough, though, we are going to start this week with what is not happening in the first weeks of the Donald J. Trump administration. And I'm just going to leave that little teaser right there.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We are also going to answer your questions. We have an amazing listener segment for you today. We have these two data scientists on the line to answer a question that you keep asking us, which is how to trust government statistics. And you guys, this is the system working. Like, you ask us, and then we ask some other listeners, and then they tell all of us, and we close the circle of life.
Also coming up in a little bit, David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, one-time commentator on this broadcast, also a former speechwriter for George W. Bush, answers our Make Me Smart question. But we begin, as we always begin, with the fix.
The news fix.
Yes.
Is what we're doing now. I have a little story to tell about the time that I stepped away from the phone for 90 minutes.
Don't do that. Have you learned nothing in the last 3 weeks of your life? Do not step away from the phone. Do not have meetings that last for more than 15 minutes. Don't do anything that takes any amount of time because the news will change.
It's like, I'm gonna feed my child. I'm going to help him practice his lines because he got the lead role.
Ooh.
He got the lead role in the musical that he tried out for in his little after-school theater program.
What's the musical?
He's playing Aladdin in Aladdin.
Nice.
I know. And then I come back to the phone.
Yes.
And our national security advisor, Michael Flynn, has resigned.
He has resigned because of the whole Russian thing, because of the month-long drip, drip, drip of what Donald Trump knew and when he knew it. But it is a metaphor, if you will, for the things that are not happening. So let me just run down some of the stuff that has been happening in the Trump administration.
Yes.
And then we can talk about what has not been happening and we can see if people can guess. So we've had the Flynn scandal and the resignation. We've had the long drawn out lawsuit and attention diverted from the executive order about immigrants from the 7 Muslim majority countries. We've had, I can't even believe I'm saying this, the Ivanka Trump thing and Kellyanne Conway and the ad that she did for the president's daughter's clothing line on national television.
Uh-huh.
We've had also just this past weekend high level, probably classified government working groups taking place in the dining room of Mar-a-Lago, the president's resort down in Florida, with the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. So that's some of the stuff that's been happening in the last, like, 10-ish days.
Yeah, this is just since we also had Steve Mnuchin back in our wheelhouse.
Yep.
Mnuchin?
Yep.
How do you say it?
Mnuchin.
Mnuchin, like Mnuchin. Minutia.
Yes, sort of. Absolutely, yes.
Confirmed as Treasury Secretary.
Yep.
Secretary. It kind of, like, this is just that was only like 2 days worth, by the way.
Yeah.
There is a great website if you want to follow all of the things that are happening. Unfortunately, I can't tell you the name of it because it has a dirty in it. And one guy already told us that he was listening with this kid when Norman Lear said the bad word. But let me just say this. It's WTFjusthappenedtoday.com, except you spell out the WTF. It is really, it has become basically my lifeline to all of to just rounding up all the stuff. There's a newsletter, thank goodness, because it is so hard to keep track.
When you take that 90 minutes away from the phone. Right?
When it's not happening again, I'll tell you that.
No, that's
but
right.
Nowhere, interestingly, in all of these happenings, I would argue, will you find the thing that people voted on in the presidential election.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're not finding stuff like an infrastructure bill, which the president campaigned on.
Nope.
You're not finding things like tax reform happening, which the president campaigned on.
Mm-hmm.
You're not finding things like NAFTA being renegotiated. You're having him have meetings with Justin Trudeau this past week, but a lot of tap dancing around it. The point being, the White House kind of can't get out of its own way on this. And for those who say, well, wait a minute, it's only been 3 weeks, let me just point out that this week in 2009,
mm-hmm.
right, with a Democrat in the White House, and this is a nonpartisan statement, right? It's the point of it is that there was a single party in control of all of Washington. There was an 800-something billion-dollar stimulus bill passed in the wake of the Great Recession, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, oh, it was terrible back then and we had to do something. I would offer this suggestion. Donald Trump campaigned on the idea that it is terrible now and we have to do something to make America great again, and yet the White House can't get out of its own way.
Well, and there was even, to be fair, I saw a tweet yesterday that went all the way back to George W. Bush and said on this day he was looking for, increased salaries for veterans. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's not just what Obama was doing. It's what almost any president was doing. And if you look at all of the ways in which the Trump administration has tied itself into quicksand-like, a quicksand of knots. Can you have that? I guess they would just unravel. But anyway.
They would drip through the hourglass like sand through the days of our lives.
Right. And that's all this feels like. And
right.
So what you're starting to see as a result, if the guiding principle of most elections is it's the economy, stupid.
Yep, yep.
Then what you're starting to see is a lot of those promises fall by the wayside and people get upset. For example, Goldman Sachs, which has just in the past week, several analysts and its chief economist starting to issue warnings about whether, in fact, the U.S. economy is going to boom to the extent that everybody was expecting once the tax code was overhauled.
But tax code overall ain't happening anytime soon. Fitch, the ratings people, did the same thing about a week ago. They said, listen, the Trump administration is a threat to the global economy because of policy uncertainty.
Well, and because of not only policy uncertainty, but actually trade war.
Well, yeah.
So although we have talked about renegotiating NAFTA and people were positive about that and they were positive about pulling out from the TPP, now you're starting to see people go, wait a second, what if renegotiating just means a disaster?
Mm-hmm.
What if they are not equipped to renegotiate and the renegotiation itself turns into a morass and we're in a trade war with Canada, which I was like, what would that even mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, it's not going well.
It's not going well. And here's the deal. And so you say to yourself, wait a second, how is it possible that we're not equipped to handle trade negotiations with Canada or Japan or anybody? And then you look at what's actually going on in the White House on a day-to-day basis where, you know, senior White House advisors are going out and saying, yes, the president has full confidence in Michael Flynn. And then 4 hours later, he resigns.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very great disconnect between the form of governing and the actuality of governing. And I don't think the White House has wrapped its brain around that yet.
And as a result, I think although the market is up, although the Dow is booming, there are concerns. There are concerns about the thing that aren't in our wheelhouse, which is the economy. And I think this is a great time for Kai to get to expand on the thing that he says on Marketplace all the time, which you always say like one sentence, which is the, you know, Wall Street's not the economy and the economy's not Wall Street.
Right.
Tell me why, because I don't exactly know.
Here's the deal, right? Wall Street and investors, and we're not talking mom and pop, right? We're talking traders and algorithms and all that jazz. They are not looking at what's going on in the political sphere. Now, they're not looking at the craziness. They're not looking at the potential trade wars. They're looking at things like tax reform is coming and corporate tax rates are going to be cut. Yay. There's going to be less regulation on Wall Street. Yay. Those kinds of things. So what you have now in the markets is an inflated sense of things are going swimmingly. Thank you very much. And for the people who are vested in that kind of thing, they're going great. They're going fine. And in the short term, everything is lovely. The question is, over the longer term, can the dysfunction in the White House possibly bear out under the strain of governing and putting into place a lot of those economic plans that the president once again promised he would deliver?
Mm-hmm.
Here, I think, though, is why all of this stuff matters. I'm going to hit this piece of tape from people that we talked to right around the time of the inauguration. They are Trump supporters. And here's what they said about why they voted for Donald Trump.
In his first 100 days, I am looking forward to the start of all the change that's been needed in this country for the past 8 years. We've got a lot of things that we need to fix, and I have no doubt that Trump and his administration are going to do it.
actually just follow his promises. I know, you know, he's had everything from immigration, VA reform, economic reform. Actually, I really want to see him get rid of a lot of the executive orders.
So I work middle class, and, you know, bringing jobs back is a big one. He's going to be a great jobs president, and we need jobs to get people off of welfare and get them out and working, bettering their lives, get education, all that stuff. So
that was Tracy Brown, Chad Balzer, and Lori Coleman in, I think they were in Washington the day before President Trump's inauguration, three of the 60-something million people in this country who voted for Donald Trump on his economic promises and aren't getting it because the White House is stumbling over its own feet.
Yeah. Well, and arguably distracted about the things that are not what people voted for. If you look at, so look, this is what we're going to keep looking at. We want to keep the conversation going. If you have thoughts, if you have answers, if you think that the focus on immigration over economics is a better approach, let us know. Follow us at Kai Rizdahl, at Molly Wood on Twitter. Use the hashtag MakeMeSmart for your pithier comments. But if you want to if you want to go in depth, and people do it, it's amazing, you can email us, MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org.
We will be back after, what, a little bit of music, I believe, with David Frum answering the Make Me Smart question. That's a catchy little tune. All right, anyway.
That was really nice.
And I'm a whistler, I'll tell you what. So I like to whistle.
You are?
I am a whistler, yes.
Can you do, like, cool whistles?
I don't know.
Are you the guy who can do the really loud whistle that makes everybody stop?
Yes, I can. I can do that, yes. Yeah. And you know what's great? So I did it with my kids when they were little. They'd be, like, off playing across the playground, and I'd give my whistle, and they would turn and come to me. It still works. My oldest is 18. I can whistle at him across the field, and he will be like, yeah, Dad, what? It's awesome. It's Pavlovian. Anyway, so moving right along. I talked to David Frum. He used to be a commentator on Marketplace, now writes for The Atlantic, used to write speeches for George W. Bush. Look up the phrase Axis of Evil. That was his. He wrote a piece not too long ago about what's going on with the Trump administration. But after we talked about that on Marketplace, I asked him the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew, but you found out you were wrong about? And here's what he said.
I graduated from college in 1982, which was the trough of a very severe recession. But for the 25 years after that recession, I lived through an American economy, a world economy, that grew at a pretty steady pace without inflation and without severe recessions. What I thought I knew was that we had solved the problem of how to moderate the extremes of the economic cycle, and that we could get by with a smaller social insurance state because the economy was going to grow at a steady pace, and the burdens of having a big government, as we'd had in the times past, was no longer needed in this new world. And that, of course, in 2008 proved to be catastrophically wrong. What I learned then was that there was a reason that the people who had lived through the 1930s put together a social insurance state, and we weren't as smart as we thought we were. We hadn't cracked that problem in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. And what they needed in the 1930s, we need again for the 21st century.
God, I love that. I want us to do – I just want one of the through lines for the show always to be this idea of growth as an assumed constant. Or
grow,
you know, we have had so many people ask us, and I have asked this many times, like, is growth – a reasonable metric for success? Is it even a realistic metric for success, or does it inevitably set you up to topple over? I just think it's so interesting.
Yes and yes. Yes.
And yet, it's the only thing that we seem to care about as, you know, business and government, all of it. Okay, so we're always going
to
lose. Good news.
Nice.
But we'll have data to save us. Next up, we're going to talk with two guys from Louisville, Kentucky, and they're very into crunching numbers. Very into crunching numbers, and they're answering our statistics questions. First, we got to pay the bills.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
So one of the things that we do here on this program is take your questions. Sometimes we ask you questions, in point of fact. If you watch our Facebook Live videos, we will actually ask you many, many questions. We've been doing it every week so far. We do it on the Aaron Marketplace. And now some questions from you.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
Yesterday on our Facebook Live video, if you saw it, I gave a little tutorial about how easy it is for you to record a little voice memo on your phone. Next week, I'm going to have to do it for Android, because I only did the iOS version voice memo. But it worked. Here is a question we got yesterday from John Green. It's related to the ongoing situation at the Oroville Dam, which is northeast of San Francisco, California. If you have not heard about the story, speaking of infrastructure, engineers are trying to keep millions of gallons of water from breaching an emergency wall, which helps relieve pressure on the primary dam so that, you know, things don't get a little apocalyptic up in here. So here's his question.
After the I-35 bridge catastrophe in Minneapolis, the national list of structurally deficient and functionally obsolete bridges gained attention. Shift now to the unfolding situation at the Oroville Dam in California, where serious erosion may be undermining the auxiliary spillway after significant damage to the primary spillway. The Mercury News is reporting folks raised concerns about the design of the auxiliary spillway 12 years ago. I wonder if there is a similar list of dam concerns and other critical infrastructure out there. I suspect it would be a long one.
Yeah, so there is a list. It is a long one. Every 4 years, a group called the American Society of Civil Engineers puts out what they call an infrastructure report card, and it actually gives you grades. Last year was last year they did it was 2013. Roads got a D. Bridges got a C plus. Dams also got a D. Here's the thing, though. U.S. infrastructure overall got a D plus. My favorite part of this entire report, the solid waste infrastructure, got a B minus. Got to be minus. And that was the only B on the whole list. So at least we know we're, you know, our solid wastes, as it were, are being taken care of.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I'm grateful for that. Yeah, I'm grateful that at least that part of our infrastructure is working. But the dam situation in particular is terrible. And again, gets back to the central thing, which is, look, these are the things, right?
Yes.
Contrary to what you are hearing about terrorism,
Amen.
For example, the things that are actually affecting our day-to-day, the things that are actually endangering lives literally at this moment, 180,000 people had to be evacuated so that in case this dam burst. Like, can you imagine the magnitude of that happening? Yeah, you can if you remember back to that I-35 thing. Like, this is bad, and this is the stuff that does need executive action quickly, and it's not happening. And whether you voted for him or not, like, I'm mad about that. Right? Those were the promises.
And we're not getting them because the White House is worried about, you know, other things.
So many things.
So the next report, so two things. One is the dam actually is not in danger, right? It's the spillways that are the hazard, right? Also, next report card comes out in March. So we'll do a quick little update on that because, you know, infrastructure, man, it's on the president's list of things to do.
Marketplace actually did a whole series on infrastructure.
We did.
And you can find it at our website, marketplace.org. Next up, though, we are flipping the script. And instead of us answering the question, we're letting you make us all a little smarter on this question that we keep coming back to. Because back in our very first full episode, we got this great question on Facebook from Nick Cawley. Numbers get thrown around a lot. How do we as citizens question the legitimacy of those numbers and or decide whether we believe them? And he says, can we have a statistics primer?
So I went on a rant because, well, this is something that bugs me. Because during the campaign, as you know, Donald Trump said very bad things about the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Janet Yellen and the regulatory framework and the statistical framework in this country. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people now just don't believe government numbers, which is a huge problem.
Yeah. And so we did not dive into the statistics part of it because it was, you know, obviously a long and complicated answer. But that is where things get awesome because it turns out that Nick Cawley himself is part of this online community. It's called Data for Democracy. And he asked them if any of them wanted to come and explain government statistics to us, which is how we found these guys.
My name is Eric Bickle. I work as an analyst within a spirits producer here in Louisville, Kentucky.
My name is Michael Weiss, and I work as a data analyst for a credit card processor. I've also done quite a bit of work with Eric in the past, working with government data. And we've written the Quantify Louisville blog together.
Quantify Louisville. I love it. Right? So the city of Louisville, Kentucky, releases out a lot of this raw local government data. Eric and Michael analyze it for fun because that's who we need on this show. And so we put that question to them, which is how can people trust government data?
As to whether you should trust statistics, there's really two parts to that, because there's one is, should you trust the numbers themselves? And then should you trust the narrative that you're receiving from those statistics? And they're very different. With government high-level published data, the definitions for those data is really accessible. The process is pretty transparent. So if you want to, you can go research any definition of any government statistic and see exactly how that's determined and how that's set up.
But as far as like clues to the data itself, do we have a good sample size? Are we hitting a large enough quantity of observations that we can assume that the statistic represents the average Joe or the average situation?
If the process was to start being changed or politicized, it would be difficult to keep that secret and you would hear about it. But outside of that, I mean, the processes have been similar for years.
And says Eric, the more data, the better.
I think that there's shades of confidence. You know, you could look at a single data point and the collection and processing and review and everything about that data point can be 100% accurate, but you may not want to run off, you know, to the hilltops and make a ton of decisions off of it, because your level of confidence just strengthens as you increase the number of observations.
I think looking at an 18-month trend in the change in the unemployment rate is much more helpful to me in understanding what's going on in unemployment versus a month-over-month change. Just because there's noise inherent in the data, and you run the risk of overreacting to a change in the data that's not necessarily part of the longer-term story.
Also, he says, just round up.
So, like, you use the unemployment number as an example. I'll just leave it at 5 until it rounds to 6. And so it also helps you to not overreact to it. So if you just glance at it and see 5.4 is 5 and 5.3 is 5, well, then you're basically forcing yourself not to overreact to those small changes.
That's what happens on a scale. No, this just ignore the point, this or that. Point 9 is nothing. Doesn't even count. What I like, this appeals to me, though, in the nerd way, because what he's basically saying is that when you want to peer review any kind of code or see if like an encryption app is trustworthy, you look for whether it's open source, whether they have published their methods, right, their methodology, and whether the data set is big enough. That makes perfect sense. But I actually... that's all great. That was an awesome answer to our original question, but I'm in love with this Quantify Louisville thing.
We want to come at this from the most unbiased approach as we can, while also looking for kind of the coolest stories to unfold. For instance, the first blog we did was looking at it's Louisville Metro Animal Services. It's kind of our animal pound, if you will. Looking at their outtake data and the outcomes data, and building out a quick little app that would predict the likelihood that if you were to drop off your dog, that it would be euthanized.
Oh, no, really? Get out. That's terrible.
This is horrible. This is like the super messed up version of the Upshotter 538.
Oh, my God. Aww. I'm sorry I'm laughing, but that's, I mean, wow. All right.
We're laughing, but we're crying.
But I'm crying a little bit inside because my dogs, I got two dogs. All right. Anyway, context, though, these guys say, as with all data, is critical.
I think a good example of context being necessary that we worked on was in the complaints research that we did, where it looked like, according to the data, that the city of Louisville was being overrun with rabies complaints. And that the city of Louisville wasn't really investigating them. They contacted us and said, well, rabies means dog bite. It's like, well, could it just be labeled as dog bite? It seems a lot more straightforward. And so... that's really what you run into, is that they didn't design their system to dump data to the public to inform them. They designed their system to manage queues of work for people. And the people that work there understand, like, oh, if it's a dog bite, select rabies. In my mind, that's the biggest growing pain that you have with local data, is that unlike the national data that's been specifically designed to share metrics, this data is created through interfaces that are designed to help people do their work, and maybe answer questions.
Oh, I love this.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting, right? And if you think about unemployment numbers like they were talking about a little while ago, you've got the main headline unemployment number that we report on Marketplace all the time. But then you've got this thing called U6, right, which is long-term unemployed and partially connected, disconnected workers and all that jazz. And it muddies the picture because people who don't understand what exactly that means say, oh, my God, unemployment's actually 17% instead of 4.7, you know, or 4.8, I guess, this month.
Well, and they're even pointing to just, like, simple factors that right. can make data. And right. I am certainly not here to argue that data is unreliable, but I also think we have a tendency to fetishize data, especially in this yep. age of sort of big data, machine learning, yep. AI. You know, I hear people talk about data as though it's the be-all, end-all. Or they say, I want to found a political party in which all decisions are made based on science and data. And I go, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Turns out you really don't, because you might end up, I don't know, killing all the dogs because you think there's tons of rabies.
Oh, hey, now, come on.
I know that went dark. I didn't mean for that to go so dark.
It totally went dark. All right, so all of that is to say, if you've got questions, we will find the answers. Send them to us. There's a handy place for that on our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart.
In addition to all of the other things, and yeah, we'll be right back.
Radio production on the fly, peeps. All right, so we were talking yesterday on our Facebook Live video about all the stuff that's happening in the White House and what's not happening as a result of it. And Molly Wood, yet again with the amazing insight, no, seriously, I mean, props where props are due, came up with this analogy.
I did. I will say I've used this one before. This particular all metaphor right. of mine comes from a favorite children's book, as so much wisdom does, about going on a bear hunt and how sometimes things are just a journey and you can't shortcut them. You cannot go over them, under them, around them. You have to go through them. And so we got so excited about this metaphor that I like reordered the book because my son is like 9 now, so I don't still have it. And we gave it to the guy other than Kai
in the LA
office who has the best voice for a dramatic reading.
We're going on a bear hunt. We're going to catch a big one. What a beautiful day. We're not scared. Uh-oh. Mud. Thick, oozy mud. We can't go over it. We can't go under it. Oh, no. We've got to go through it.
Oh, my God.
Squelch, squirch. Squelch, squirch.
We've got to
squelch,
go through it. Oh, man.
So
that
happy
is
right
your
now.
Make me smart moment of Zen right there.
The book is called We're Going on a Bear Hunt. And let me get the authors for you because I know you're all going to want to get it, not just for your children, but for your life lessons.
That by your bedside, man.
It's called We're Going on a Bear Hunt by Michael Rosen and Helen Oxenbury. And let me tell you, this is not a total spoiler, but much like, much again, a metaphor for what's happening in life right now.
Yeah.
They get a little more than they bargained for. Sometimes that happens. And that is it for today.
We gotta go. Man, oh man. All right, you know what that music means? It means we gotta go. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, and senior producer Nancy Fargali. Special thanks to John Buckley this week, the distinguished gentleman.
Amazing. This week's program and all the music, the amazing music you have heard so far. The program was engineered by Ben Tolliday, and Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music.
The executive producer at Marketplace Productions Worldwide is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I just gave us all a big promotion.
And thanks to all of you. Thanks to all of you. Oh, happy Valentine's Day.
Oh man. I'm in so much trouble. Oh, I'm in so much trouble.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.